is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's morning show, I am really excited that I can reconnect, with a very important person at Carthage College where I teach. His name is Roger Mariano. He is the Assistant Dean of Students, and he is Director of Equity and Inclusion, and co-director of the Equity and Inclusion Committee that oversees many of these really central and pressing concerns that Carthage, and for that matter, all kinds of schools of higher learning are grappling with right now to make their schools, in terms of student body and faculty and staff, as inclusive and welcoming and fair and equitable as is humanly possible. And Carthage is really undertaking some very important initiatives that are related to many of these significant goals. And so I'm really happy that we can have Roger Mariano with us to talk about this and about the work that he has done in this field over the course of his long career. Roger Mariano, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about some of the important work that you are doing specifically at Carthage, I think it would be good for our listeners to hear a little bit about you personally, where you come from originally, something about your background and interests, and then from there into the professional life that you have enjoyed that ultimately took you to Carthage.
Yeah, wow. So life story here, huh? So here we go. Yeah, thanks, Greg. So I think if I were to trace back my roots in terms of how I got into this work, but it has largely to do with where I come from and my life experience. And so I grew up on the north side of Chicago. I was the child of a Puerto Rican mother and an Ecuadorian father who came to Chicago as adults from home. My mom came from Jayuya, Puerto Rico, when she was a teenager, and my father came from Quito, Ecuador when he was in his mid to late 20s. And so they met on the north side of Chicago, and I was raised there along with my younger brother. And Spanish was our first language spoken in our household. And so for me early on, grappling with trying to adjust to an English-speaking culture and the norms of our country, I have vivid memories of that, especially in my younger years in schooling. And so we moved around a lot. My dad was a factory worker. My mom stayed home with my brother and I. And my dad, unfortunately, had many instances where the factory jobs were being cut. And so we moved around a lot, so much so that I was in six different schools by the time I was in fourth grade. And I think that planted the seeds for me in terms of a sense of belonging, because everywhere I went, it was a struggle as a kid to try to fit in. And on top of that, kind of having experiences where kids made fun of how my parents spoke, how I spoke, and, you know, having the sense of not belonging so much that it really stayed with me throughout my time growing up. And so as I got into junior high school and high school, things got a lot better. and especially into college. But those seeds had been planted, and I was always someone who had a mind toward or a real recognition of when people were being bullied or didn't feel like they belonged. I always connected with that experience. I think those seeds were planted very early. Go ahead, Greg.
I'm just curious, when you say that things got better as you got into junior high and high school, I'd be really curious to know why. And yeah. If your experience in part was that maybe you got involved in things in which some of those differences did not matter as much. I know that sometimes when young people find themselves playing sports or playing in the band or singing in choir or whatever, those can be arenas in which certainly those issues and concerns don't magically melt away.
Right.
But to some extent, that often is a place where somebody like yourself can really find a significant sense of belonging. Are we talking about something like that, is it for other reasons that it got better?
No, I think it's right on target. I think that's, you know, getting involved in things helped. So I think there were a couple of factors. So first of all, I am one of the lighter complected skinned folks in my own family. So I think that definitely gave me an advantage in some ways of fitting into some circles. But I also was a decent athlete. And so I played baseball and basketball and was pretty good at those sports. Not great, but good. And I think that got me into some social circles that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. And so, connecting on an athletic field obviously helps us transcend barriers and boundaries in many ways. And so those were the moments where I found a lot of joy in my high school experience in particular, and in middle school. So I think that definitely helped. And as I connected and made friends with folks, the friends that I connected with, who I still stay in touch with to this day, were very much folks who made me feel by and large like I fit in. And college was a little bit of a different experience. I had a good experience in college as well, but there were still many moments where I felt like I didn't fit in. And it was just always a constant kind of struggle to just get connected and to feel like I belong. And so that stayed with me. And after about 4 years of doing different jobs that, you know, I thought would somehow get me up an economic ladder, especially with my parents convincing me to get a secure job and start a family and those kind of things, it wasn't working for me. And I was finding myself really kind of going through the motions, passionate, but without passion, in the professions I had been involved in, and I just wanted something more. And it wasn't until I got into higher ed in 1997 that things changed for the better for me, and I started finding passion in my work and a connection to a real purpose through the work that I was doing.
I noticed on your resume that for 12 years you were director of intercultural student affairs at Elmhurst College, a really interesting small school in the western suburbs of Chicago. I just want to ask you for a moment about that work that you did there and that kind of intriguing title of Director of Intercultural Student Affairs. I think there's a lot wrapped up in that word, intercultural.
Yeah, Elmhurst College, now known as Elmhurst University, was a really great experience for me. There were huge challenges when I was there, but at the same time, it was a really, really great experience. And the idea behind intercultural is really moving a few steps deeper and further into the continuum of really understanding what multiculturalism or interculturalism is. And so, the idea is that the word multicultural or diversity implies that you can have a diverse population or a diverse community in terms of the makeup of the community. But in many instances, especially at a predominantly white institution like Elmhurst or like a Carthage, you can have diverse communities, but you can have very limited or no interaction among those communities. And so intercultural really implies an intentional effort to build community with intentional outreach and intentional connections between groups, communities, experiences, and so forth, so that individuals can grow and learn from one another and really understand as much as we want to understand our similarities, to also understand our differences and why that's important. When I was at Elmhurst, I was I think that's where my career really started to develop some of the foundational experiences and pieces that allowed me to do what I'm doing here at Carthage. But I was able to spearhead and lead off-campus retreats, programs on campus that help support the student body, student organizations. I worked with colleagues like my wonderful friend Laura Wilmarth Tyna, who is now at Lewis University, and we collaborated to do off-campus international service learning experiences through Habitat for Humanity. So just wonderful experiences there, wonderful people there, and the students that I connected with to this day I stay in touch with and are a memory I'll carry with me. And I feel personally proud of some of the work that we did there and the connections that we made with students to allow them to grow and flourish and become, you know, productive, involved, engaged citizens in the world, which I see happening in the years that have followed my departure there.
Speaking today on the morning show with Roger Moriano, who is Assistant Dean of Students at Carthage College and also Director of Equity and Inclusion. And in a few moments, we're going to be talking about a plan of action undertaken by Carthage, announced in early July, in terms of Carthage on many different levels, working against racism, both within the college and also in the outer community and the outer world. Roger Moriano, tell us about coming to Carthage, when that occurred and what opportunity was offered to you, and what attracted you to come to Carthage and to do this work here.
Yeah, so I arrived at Carthage in July of 2017. And in that spring, when I had seen the position open, there are a couple of factors that really influenced my wanting to come here. Number one is that as much as I appreciated my experience at Elmhurst, it was quite a commute, and it had been kind of a commute that had been taxing for quite a while. And so the idea of cutting my commute in half was definitely attractive, for sure, from a personal perspective. But from an opportunity perspective and as a career perspective, an office like this in the Division of Student Affairs had not really existed before, to my knowledge. And so the chance to really help build something new, to help create something from the ground up, to help really give a boost to the really great grassroots work that had been happening at Carthage from folks like Dr. Sandy Basiglia and Dr. Michelle Hancock and others who were really doing what they could from their positions to move the institution in the direction where it really started living these principles and these foundational values was a really great a pull for me. And I really felt like I could really be a part of something where I can help create something from the ground up that could outlast all of us and can really leave a legacy that'll last for generations and really take Carthage to a place that it hadn't been before. So all of that was very enticing to me. And then, you know, having the opportunity to work with some great people who I met during my interview, I thought this is definitely going to be a good move for me.
So explain the situation, and this maybe is belaboring the obvious, but I don't really think so, actually, although someone might hear this question and think that. What kind of problem or array of problems are we talking about that would make it necessary to have a director of equity and inclusion and to have an office that is devoted to doing work in this respect? What kind of sort of shortcomings are we talking about or areas of real concern that make this kind of work as significant as it obviously is?
That's a great question, because that question kind of reminds me a little bit of some of the feedback I've gotten over the years doing this kind of work. So I'll briefly just tell you that on a handful of occasions, I've had people, random people that I don't know very well, or people that I know somewhat well, come and ask me and you know, about the work that I do and ask if that was even a real job. You know, the idea or the suggestion being that's, I actually had one individual, my wife was with me when this happened, one individual tell me that my job was BS, you know, and that it was just a not necessary, it's a made up thing that we have going on in higher education. So there's a reality that attitude is out there, but the real reason we have positions like this and initiatives like this and attention to these types of issues is because we know from decades of research what the experiences of underrepresented students are in higher education, particularly at predominantly white institutions. We know that. We know the patterns that students of color, for example, LGBTQIA plus students, we know the things that they're likely to experience in higher ed. And the reason why these experiences occur is because we are a microcosm of society. and all higher ed institutions are a microcosm of what happens in the world outside of higher ed. And so when we think about it, every year we have about, at Carthage, about 750, 800 or so first year students who arrive on campus. And when they arrive on campus, they arrive with a collected 18 years or so of experiences and lessons and moments and teachings and just different ways that their life experience has shaped their worldview through their family, through their faith traditions, through their communities, through time with friends or family. And that happens, and it helps shape us. And folks arrive from rural places, from suburban places, from urban centers, all with different stories, right? And inevitably, when you have this collection of folks that arrive on a new campus every year, you have 800 different stories, 800 different ways potentially of viewing the world. And in some instances, those views of the world will be very open-minded, and in some instances, they won't. And we see these instances play out in the interactions that students have with one another in the classrooms, in the residence halls, and in their general experiences on campus. And in some instances, those experiences don't play out very positively. They can be very destructive and harmful. And so we have to pay attention to that, because we know that the experiences students have on college campuses have direct correlations to their own personal development, their potential professional development, and through their academic performance and how much they reach their full potential. A huge barrier to having students from underrepresented groups actually do well includes how much of a sense of belonging students have on a college campus like ours. So we have to understand these issues fully. We have to understand how difference plays out in the college student experience, and really understand what it means for students reaching their full potential. So that's just one of many reasons. A second reason I would give is the staggering fact that we have a huge deficiency in racial literacy and other types of education and understanding of issues when it comes to equality, access, and opportunity in our country. Who has access, who doesn't, and historically, who hasn't had access and who has. And so having a good understanding of that is important for us to be able to better serve the needs of our students by understanding how we got to where we're at today. And I think on another level, and on a very practical level, we are in our society and in our globe more than ever in an increasingly interdependent, intercultural world in any realm or profession or career that you get into. So having our students prepared to interact and spend time in those worlds, in their professions, in their careers, regardless of what they go into, they have to be able to demonstrate the life skills of being able to work with difference, across difference, seamlessly and effectively in order to do good work in the world. And Carthage prides itself on putting out graduates who meet the needs of the world, as President Swallow states so well. And so in order to do that, we have to do the work to really prepare our students to be exposed to difference, understand what difference means in their own lives, and how they can grow and develop as individuals.
I think one thing that might be really helpful for our listeners is to really come to a clearer understanding of what you mean by difference, and the fact that that term is, I suspect, as you're using it, far broader than someone might think in kind of a knee-jerk reaction, that this is about, for instance, black and white, and a largely white school where you have a relatively small number of students of other color that feel like they are very much and in fact are an underrepresented population in terms of the balance. But, and not that that is not a significant matter to be thinking about and aware of, but I think you're talking about difference that ranges far beyond that. Just what are we talking about when we're talking about difference and being aware of difference and understanding difference and, in a sense, reaching across difference?
Well, we're clearly talking about all forms of human diversity as we can understand and connect with. And so, you know, in addition to cultural identity and the many identities we carry, whether it be socioeconomic or, you know, a person with a diverse ability or disability, a person who happens to identify as LGBT, different faith traditions, racial, ethnic backgrounds, we're talking about all of that. But we're also talking about a a range of diverse ideas as well, diverse perspectives on the world. That all is stuff that we need to address and pay attention to, and that we attempt to do. And there is a narrative out there that the diversity of ideas, for example, is not something that is valued in universities or higher ed. And that's something that I think is couldn't be farther from the truth. And so we see examples of ideas being challenged all the time in higher education. And that is an important part of the process of teaching folks how to think critically and how to understand the difference between ideas that hold merit based on logic, reasoning, evidence, and so forth, and ideas that don't hold as much merit or don't hold as much weight. And to be able to distinguish the difference between the two is something that we try to really pay attention to in our programming here, because as we see many examples in our society to this day, there are lots of examples of ideas and positions and perspectives that are shared in our society that often don't hold evidence, but that people believe anyway. And I think that's something that we have to really pay attention to. And it's crucial in the development of our students.
Interesting. For instance, if somebody fervently believes in astrology, this is obviously something in which there is absolutely no scientific basis whatsoever for such a belief to be espoused. And yet some people believe that. Some people might want to start an astrology club. Or in whatever way, I mean, explore that and celebrate that and so on, versus somebody who holds an idea that does have some basis in reality or scientific reality, but might be very much a distinct and maybe uncommon view or something. So I guess part of your challenge is to help students, and for that matter, faculty and staff, kind of understand the difference and make sense of the difference.
Yeah, and a lot of what I've seen in the past decade, in particular in the last few years, has been a society in which people regard opinions in a way that I haven't seen in the past. And so, for example, generally when you express an opinion on a topic or a subject, the opinion is certainly your perspective on it, but it also is rooted in some factual information to provide evidence of why you've arrived at your opinion. So Greg, you and I might have a difference of opinion on musical genres that we think are quote unquote better in terms of musical ability and context and musical talent and the skill set required to deliver that style of music. We might have different opinions on that, but we might also be able to deliver those opinions based on factual evidence of that style of music that we are drawn to. But what I'm seeing and what's troubling, what we see a lot, and we have to really work with college students on and our entire higher education system, is to have folks distinguish the difference between what an opinion is and what a fact is. And so you and I might say, and the way it's played out in society might be, let's take 3 times 3, right? So 3 times 3 equals 9, but I might have the opinion that 3 times 3 equals 6 because you have 3 and you have 3, that's 6. And so then if I, mathematically we know that that's not true, but then I might say, well, I'm sorry, that's just my opinion and we can agree to disagree. And that's where we're at right now, is we are losing the ability to distinguish what actual facts are and to come to a reasonable place of disagreement on issues, but we have to have a foundation of facts. And that's much of what we do with our intercultural diversity, equity, and inclusion work here on campus, is we want to distinguish what's factual in our society, what's happening in our society, what's happened in the past in our society, so that students understand that equity and inclusion means the recognition that society was often structured in a way that benefited and advantaged some to the disadvantage of others. And that's not a narrative that we're taught about our society and our country, but we have to come to that reality and understanding in order to really dismantle the barriers that have kept some groups from having full access and full opportunity to reach their full potential. In addition to that, it's also important to understand in that history that each time underrepresented groups have had the opportunity to move forward and have made some progress, the groups in power typically have responded in some sort of backlash to try to take back what they had. So understanding those factual moments in history helps us understand how to address the issues that happen now. We might have different opinions on how to address issues of socioeconomic conditions in inner cities, for example. We might have different ideas on what economic ideology or philosophy is best to move society forward. Those are all valid because they're rooted in sound ideas and foundational ideas of what might or might not work. But when you can't agree on just what's factual, that's a problem. And your astrology example is a good one as well.
So Carthage is obviously very serious about trying to come to terms with some of these concerns and issues. And Carthage is not alone. This is something that is a very significant part of the world of higher education right now. Is there any particular reason why we are seeing such intense, even ferocious attention being paid to this at this moment in our history? What do you think is driving this more than anything? I mean, this intense concern.
I absolutely agree that we are in a moment that's unlike other moments in the past. And so, and just to give you a couple of perspectives from my point of view, I think that the intense focus, as you describe it, has always been there for communities who have been underrepresented or oppressed or marginalized. And I think that white America, when it comes to race, for example, hasn't listened enough. And so I think what we're describing is the majority in our country actually paying much more attention to this, to these issues, especially when it comes to race. I think it's not a controversial statement to say that the George Floyd, murder that took place in Minneapolis this summer was the turning point. It was a tipping point in our society, because I think for many white Americans, it was the first time probably visibly seeing the sheer brutality of what took place, caught on camera, and the callousness in which it took place, in which it occurred. The look on that police officer's face, I think, is something that is stated quite a bit by folks who just really couldn't believe and fathom that that was actually happening. And so I think that really caused some people to pause and really just reconsider ideas about what race is like in America. I've heard from many folks I know in my life, professionally and personally, who for decades have said, race is no longer an issue in America. If you just work hard enough, if you can make my company make more money, I will hire you. And that is a perspective that we want to believe about our country. It's a perspective we want to attain. But the data, and there's plenty of data out there, demonstrate otherwise, that the experiences of marginalized communities in this country are not what we want them to be or we believe them to be. And so I think that the George Floyd incident was a tipping point. We suddenly saw organizations like the Washington Football Team in the NFL, which has an owner, Daniel Snyder, who vowed several years ago to never change the name of the Washington Football Team. And suddenly, because FedEx, which owns the field that the Washington team plays on, and other huge corporations said that they weren't going to pony up the money to support and to support the team in any way, suddenly that money talked, right? And suddenly Washington decided to change its name, and they are in the process of finding a new name, something I never thought would happen personally. And many other examples of organizations. The Cleveland baseball team just announced yesterday they're doing the same thing. And so, and many other organizations like the NBA putting out, messages, anti-racism messages on their basketball courts during their season. And we saw corporations now suddenly, it was funny, Greg, I had a bunch of folks contact me who do this work in higher ed saying, oh my gosh, look at these jobs popping up. Because suddenly every corporation wanted to have a director or a chief diversity officer that they wanted to hire, right? And so suddenly people were doing this work because I think, number one, I think people saw the need for it. People saw that, you know, what happened this summer really revealed a lack of understanding of these issues to the point where we really need to be on top of this stuff to really pay attention to these things. That I think in the past, these issues were viewed as just people learning how to get along with one another. I actually had a professor once years ago share with me their perspective after I delivered a diversity, equity, and inclusion workshop, came to me and said, thank you, I just wasted my time learning how to be nice to people, right? That was the perspective, that all this is learning how to be nice to people, right? Yeah. But I think organizations and our society and communities are starting to understand that it goes well beyond that. It's the understanding that difference matters, and this goes back to how we started this conversation, that understanding difference means that you recognize difference. It means that colorblindness, for example, doesn't work. That colorblindness, meaning that I don't see color, I just treat everyone the same, misses the mark in terms of understanding that people of color quite often have different experiences than their white colleagues, counterparts, community members, neighbors, often when they share a same experience. And so we have to understand what it means to be Muslim in America, to be a transgender person in America, what it means to be a person with a disability, that it means that I have different experiences, and often these experiences are rooted in having lack of access or doors being closed to me. And if we don't understand that, if we don't want to understand that, we will never make progress. And so we have to understand difference, and we have to make a difference. And I think companies are realizing that also in a global market, in order to expand the size of the market and the number of potential people that they will reach with their products or with their services, they have to understand what makes those communities tick. How do we connect with folks? How do we make ourselves appeal more to folks who we haven't connected with before? I think people are seeing untapped markets in terms of communities that they can reach that they had not paid attention to in the past. So I think all those factors are converging to really make a difference in the shift that we are seeing. And on top of that, I mentioned earlier how when we've had movement forward among underrepresented communities, there's been a backlash, and we are in the middle of a backlash right now in our society. We are seeing white supremacist groups, for example, being much more visible and open and very much emboldened to share messages of I want to burn a Black Lives Matter banner, and I want to march in the streets and protest against some of these things that are happening. So this is the challenge of our time right now. We're in the middle of an important moment in our society, and I believe when we look back on this 20, 30 years from now in our history classes, this will be a pivotal moment in our history when it comes to access and opportunity.
One of the things you just said made me think about this in a way that I really had not before, and that is the fact of understanding and acknowledging and appreciating difference versus ignoring difference, which is maybe a more sort of juvenile or immature way of trying to approach this. That idea that I have a neighbor and they're Black, but on some level, subconsciously at least, I'm just going to pretend they're white. I'm going to try to overlook the fact that they're Black. I mean, if that on some level makes me nervous or apprehensive, I'm just gonna pretend that they're just like me, and I think we'll get along just fine. And that is one way to be, I suppose, cordial, but that's not a way to really understand somebody, to stand where they stand, to appreciate what they have been through and maybe the particular challenges that they face. And so I think what you're calling us to do is to understand one another, including our differences, to not be afraid of our differences or not to overlook them in a way that ultimately is kind of disrespectful.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point you make. There's no doubt in my mind that the vast majority of times when I hear someone say, I don't see color, it really is a well-intended, sincere place that person is coming from, of really wanting to treat every individual with respect and dignity. But as you state, when you deny an aspect of a person's identity in the attempt to bring comfort and bring us to a place that kind of bypasses the actual lived experiences of folks who are different than you, you're kind of, again, making yourself the focus of the moment that you're in, and in some ways making your comfort a little bit more of a priority than that person's lived experience. And so we have to be okay with discomfort. We have to be okay with the narratives that we've told ourselves about our communities and our societies might not be exactly as they are. And it's super important to understand that even with the best of intentions, the impact could be detrimental and harmful. And it goes back to kind of a couple of platitudes that our society holds dear, you know, the golden rule, which so many people are familiar with, which tells us, you know, you treat others the way I want to be treated. But there's also the platinum rule, right? And that's treat others the way they want to be treated. And so there's a distinct difference there of understanding that maybe what I think is best for someone else might not be best. And maybe I should listen more. And I think that's important.
I think one really difficult point of contention, or sometimes is a point of contention, is when people see something that is truly horrifying, such as what happened to George Floyd or what happened to Jacob Blake, or you know, any number of incidents that any civilized human being would be horrified by. It is really easy to say we haven't managed to change anything, or nothing has changed, or this is exactly the way it's always been. I mean, despite what we might want to believe to the contrary. And I know that some people, I count myself among them, do feel some concern about that, because that disregards the undeniable progress that has been made in many of these issues. And it's when one looks at the unvarnished history of what we have come from, I don't see how anyone could say that we have not made progress. And yet we don't want to acknowledge progress and allow it to then make us complacent, to live with that which we just simply should not tolerate. How would you have us think about the progress that we have made thus far, in a way that will be helpful to make still more progress as we proceed from here?
Well, I think you stated it well, where we can't become complacent. And so certainly the abolishment of slavery and the ridding ourselves of Jim Crow laws is certainly movement forward. But when you also consider that the overt Jim Crow laws themselves might not be in place, but similar policies, laws, and ordinances and practices continue to plague our nation, although they're not named or as overt. And so it's been a very slow process to get folks to dismantle barriers that are systematically disadvantaging folks. And so we have to understand that while there's some progress happening, we don't have the overt lynchings that were taking place well into the 1970s. But we also, you know, have other forms of, you know, hurting communities of color, for example, or transgender individuals. You know, we have to understand and have the ability to hold a mirror up to ourselves all the time, not just looking at the rearview mirror of history, but looking at a mirror in the present day as well. And so, you know, to give you examples, you know, we have all too often across the country on college campuses, the experiences of trans students, for example, feeling fearful of being on campus, feeling like their experience is not validated or supported. Experiences being in the classroom, having professors say that there are only two genders and you basically are invisible or don't count. And so those constant reinforcing ideas or thoughts of not belonging have huge impacts on individuals and their ability to feel like they can reach their full potential. In addition to the number of instances when trans or LGBT students are harassed, intimidated, bullied, or physically assaulted. And so these things happen on a regular basis. So while our society has made movement forward in some ways, for example, marriage equality is still currently the law of the land, we still have backlashes to that. Let's take, for example, the inability now of transgender troops to serve in our military, despite anyone who wants to do that and serve their country, they're being denied that opportunity. So every movement forward tends to backlash, as Dr. King stated on multiple occasions. And so we must be aware that while we move forward, there's always the ability present to move backward, and we must be vigilant at all times to make sure we're heading in the right direction.
Right. And of course, even if in the big picture there is some momentum forward, those backlashes, even when they occur in corners of the world, I mean, whoever experiences that, it's tremendously painful and harmful to them. And so it's nothing that should be minimized. And of course, Dr. King's work, some of the most difficult work he did was in the North, in places that people had simplistically assumed was a place without systematic racism, as was so well known in the South. But the fact that it was often subtle or done behind closed doors or in ways not immediately apparent to the to the naked eye, that made it all the more insidious and all the more vexing. And some of the most painful moments that Dr. King experienced in his great work happened in trying to combat that kind of racism. I suppose that is a truth we need to remember too.
Yeah, it's interesting because I often use the example of Dr. King's life in order to understand today's issues that we are dealing with, in particular, attitudes toward movements. And so, for example, Black Lives Matter is a movement that has that provokes interesting and very emotional responses from people in our society who maybe partially understand what the movement is about or what it's trying to do. And it's interesting to me to find that when I look at the responses to Dr. King and the civil rights movement, I almost see the same patterns of responses among white Americans to these movements. And so I think it's interesting to note that people say, well, Black Lives Matter is a Marxist movement. They said so themselves, right? And then you don't realize that Dr. King himself was accused of being a communist, and he openly shared that he attended communist meetings and tried to learn different perspectives, Marxist perspectives or other perspectives, in an effort to really have a fuller picture of just how to address the very big challenges that, you know, you're looking for any kind of ideas that could help move things in the right direction. You know, Dr. King, in a poll that, you know, came out in the 50th anniversary of his assassination in 2018, showed that over 90% of Americans approved of Martin Luther King Jr., that he is beloved universally in our society in many ways. He's seen as a beacon and a hero for peace and for justice and for honesty and for, you know, moving societies forward and bringing people together and breaking the color barrier in so many ways. And yet, we do this all the time. We see Dr. King through the rearview mirror of history, not realizing that when people looked in the mirror, or if they looked in the mirror at the time of his, when he was alive, they would have seen how white America in particular viewed Dr. King, which was not positive. At the time of his death, he had about a 20 to 25% approval rating. He was called by the FBI as one of the greatest threats to our way of life. He was called the most notorious liar in American history by J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI at the time. He was surveilled by the FBI and seen as a threat to our society. And so he was not a popular figure and was seen as divisive. He was told he was divisive. He was told he was un-American. He was told he didn't appreciate our military when he criticized the Vietnam War, and on and on. And so in the moment, we are always, we find ourselves unable to see the bigger picture of what's attempted to be done by these leaders. But in the rearview mirror of history, we can hold them with high regard and with adoration and with the ideas that, you know, this was a man of principle and honor. So it's an interesting facet of our understanding of these issues that I try to bring forward.
The anti-racism plan laid out by Carthage in early July, which is called, and I like this, a plan of action, seeks to address some of these issues in really important ways, including trying to close the achievement gap of some of these students, expanding resources to address some of these issues. And what I want to give you a moment to talk about is the idea of really infusing education about some of these issues throughout the Carthage curriculum. In other words, to not just create a class called Racism in America and address these things head on, but to actually take some of this, some of these realities, some of these issues, and fold them into other courses that at a glance might not have anything to do with this. Can you just say a word about what you would like to see happen with this facet of Carthage's anti-racism plan?
Yes, and so I think what you hit was, what you addressed hit the target. You know, what we wanna do is create culturally inclusive and responsive curricula all across the disciplines. And so in so many of our disciplines, we are talking about ultimately the human experience, whether it be in teaching or nursing or in business, we're still talking about interaction and working with human beings. And so there's an opportunity to really understand how we can infuse a diversity, diverse experiences of different human populations and communities within any of our disciplines that we teach. But in addition to that, that legacies of racism or foundational course and courses that are developed to understand racial issues and other issues of marginalization and oppression are absolutely necessary in order to have sound conversations and a grasp and understanding of the concepts on how we can help and support and interact with and lift up all communities in any of the work that we do in any field that we go into. And so that's all going to be intertwined and interconnected in the type of work that we do in and out of the classroom. So the anti-racism plan of action is designed to really prioritize the diversity of human experience in all of our disciplines and how we show up every day in our work. It's providing opportunities for new faculty and staff who are hired by the institution to go through educational moments and experiences where they can learn how to better interact with one another and better serve our students, because we understand these issues with greater depth. It is looking at our practices every day in our departments and asking ourselves, do we discriminate? I think it's a very simple question we can ask ourselves daily. Do we discriminate in our practices, in our policies, in our actions? And who are the invisible populations on campus who maybe we don't hear enough about or don't consider enough about because they are invisible or marginalized or, you know, just not seen, and that we don't hear from, that we might be not serving to our best of our ability because we haven't considered their needs. And so those are all, it's really about changing the entire culture to make equity and inclusion an aspect and a facet of our values that we think about daily and that becomes part of a consciousness of the institution and the ethos of the institution, so that we're not thinking about these things when an incident occurs. We're thinking about it all the time because it is who we are.
Roger Mariano is Assistant Dean of Students at Carthage College and heading up the college's widespread efforts to be a more inclusive and diverse place. Roger Mariano, I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about your important work, and I thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Greg, thank you so much. I think before I leave, I just wanted to note that this institutional effort by Carthage involves quite a few people, and we have some great faculty and staff, faculty, like I mentioned before, with Dr. Hancock and Dr. Basiglia and so many others that have been instrumental to moving this across the campus. And so while we might have a new intercultural center and an equity and inclusion office, this is truly a campus-wide multiple person effort, including my assistant director, Cecily Hunter. We are all invested in this, and we're trying to move us in a direction for the better. So thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear the interview I recorded with Shana Gazit, who is director and producer of a fascinating documentary that will air next week as part of the PBS series American Experience. It tells the story of Elizabeth Friedman, who was an incredibly gifted and skilled codebreaker. And she did very important work for the United States during both World War I and World War II. But her story was deeply shrouded in secrecy, in part because the files pertaining to her work for the U.S. government, the U.S. military, were classified until very, very recently. The story told in a new documentary, and we'll talk about it tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we remind you that you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast and hear a new Morning Show 7 days a week. It's available on Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg.